cliche or not, but when Ashley Harris opened his heart to someone he didn't know, he felt a weight had been lifted off his shoulders. It was a turning point for a young man who had previously been active in sport and invested in college life, only to find himself, as he says, with a 60-year-old body beneath a 22-year-old mind. A cocktail of prescription drugs to ease the constant pain and a slow but sure decline into a gambling addiction led Ashley to a dark place that he did not like. The intervention of this stranger in a hospital room helped him, as did the love of his partner and young family. Ashley walks us through his experience in golf, his aspirations, the diagnosis of rheumatoid arthritis, and how, one Halloween, it all came to a head. In this honest and at times deep conversation, Ashley explains how his active sporting life was turned upside down after receiving the diagnosis. With that diagnosis came the realization that things would be different, and that the physical pain, silent to everyone except him, would be a constant companion. With thoughtful reflection, Ashley explains what golf means to him and how it can help others. We experienced a few technical issues with the audio during this conversation. I hope that it does not spoil what really is quite a roller coaster ride with Ashley Harris. Well, Ashley, thank you very much for making the time to have a chat tonight. It's most appreciated. I know it's pretty cold where you are right now. What's it look like outside of your front door?
White at the moment, and it's getting whiter as well. It's currently snowing now, so not much golf being planned for this weekend.
No, I'm sure. You play quite a bit of golf quite close to yourself, don't you?
Yeah, yeah. I actually have a job at the moment at my golf club, so any spare time that I have, I generally spend at the golf club hitting balls and take my boy down as well, because he's just getting into golf as well. So.
Okay, great. How old is he?
He's 8, so yeah, he's getting there slowly.
So you're getting him started early?
Yes, yes.
Tell me a little bit about yourself when you got started. How young were you when you started to play the game?
In golfing terms and sort of starting a sport, it was actually quite late. So I didn't start playing golf till I was about 14. My brother, who's a younger brother, he actually started when I was about 8 or 9. But I never took golf as a good sport then. I found it quite boring at that point. And he went with granddad and practiced and went and had lessons and stuff. I was more into my football and stuff like that, so I didn't find it very interesting.
You were a pretty active youngster, weren't you? You played football, rugby, I think badminton.
Yeah.
All of that before you took up golf. And
yeah, yeah. There weren't many lunch times I was practicing a sport of one t'other, so yeah, most of my spare time was sport-orientated, put it that way.
And you mentioned your grandfather got you started. Was he a good player?
He was probably your average club golfer in that respect. He played in Wales, just up the road from where Bradley Dredge plays or is a member of. And he got, obviously, my younger brother into it when he was younger. And like I say, he was probably the average club golfer. He went up there and sort of knocked the ball around. He had I think at the time he had about 18 handicap, so he never sort of hit the grand heights of being single figures or anything, but it was good enough to sort of show us round and show us how to swing the golf club.
And where was it that you started to play?
So I was actually brought up in Devon, so I was right in the middle of Devon, so we had a little par 3 golf course which was probably only sort of 10 minutes away from the house by car. So I actually joined him with my brother just out of interest on one of his birthday parties, because he had his friends go around this par 3 golf course, and rather than be left out, I sort of joined in. And after about the 9th hole of the 18 holes, I'd sort of caught the bug at that point. So.
Right. And you improved quite quickly, didn't you? I think by the time you were sort of 16 or so, you had a pretty low handicap.
Yeah, because when obviously being a sportsman already, I'd sort of got that sort of sportsman attitude where as soon as you get the bug, you want to get as good as you can, as quick as you can. So many hours were spent practicing and going back to that par 3 golf course and going round and round and round. There'd often be days where I'd sort of do 54 holes in a day. Obviously, it's only par 3, so it didn't take half as long as it would for a full course. But that sort of got the sort of short game and the sort of short iron skills in quite good nick. So when it came to actually going onto a full golf course, other than sort of learning how to hit a driver straight, most of it was all quite sort of straightforward in getting the scoring zone, essentially.
Yeah, yeah. And did you have any coach that was helping you to reach your potential?
Not at that point, no. Not until I went to college did I actually have a lesson. It was all sort of self-taught and practicing and doing it all sort of my own way and that sort of thing. Even then, like, YouTube videos didn't really exist or anything, so it was really just sort of watching it on TV, obviously when the Open and that were on, the Masters, and sort of just trying to pick up things. And yeah, and like I say, it's just practicing over and over again as well. So,
and you said you went to college. Was that the, am I right in thinking this was the Academy of Golf at Exeter College?
Yes. Yeah. So actually, when I started college, I was doing 3 A levels, PE, English language and geography. And I actually joined the college as a rugby academy student, because obviously at the time I was playing rugby as well. But the halfway through the year, they decided they were going to set up a golf academy. And it was at that point where I sort of asked if I could sort of transfer myself over. So from that point, we then transferred myself over to the golf side, and we were actually getting lessons from a pro called Gary Milne at Exeter Golf and Country Club. And then we were getting sort of physical training, which was the first real sort of golf-specific physical training that I got from Gregor Townsend's actual brother, Craig Townsend. So Gregor Townsend, who is the current Scotland Rugby Union coach, his brother was coaching us in physical training at that time. So learned quite a lot at quite a rate of speed at that point. Like, we used PGA training diaries to sort of note down what we were practicing. All our stats were taken down each round that we played. And it was quite intensive, but it was totally aimed at getting the best out of you as quickly as possible. And at that point, obviously being at college age, you're heading towards, some of the group were heading towards going to do their PGA or their playing exam to move into being professional. So I was probably the furthest behind, I would say, at that point in the group. Many of them were sort of very low handicap, sort of 2 or scratch or getting on to plus figures. So at that stage, I was sort of trying to catch up, which sort of drove me on to picking up as many tips and lessons as possible.
It seems like you were pretty determined to make your way in the game at that stage, because I know that you caddied for Tongchai Jaidi at the Welsh Open in 2010. Worked at the, I think you worked also in the Ryder Cup that year as well at Celtic Manor.
Yeah, so 2010 I left college, Exeter College, and went up to Kingston University to do golf business management degree. So that involved being actually stationed at Marriswood College in Guildford. And from that, we were in our first year, we were offered the chance to go and work at the Ryder Cup as a volunteer with the university. So the whole week there, we spent in the retail tent, worked with all the various suppliers in that retail tent, sort of restocking, stocking shelves, sort of helping customers out.
I'm not too sure you'd be walking around too much that one. I remember I was at that Ryder Cup and you were probably swimming around. It was a really wet Ryder Cup, wasn't it?
Yes.
In fact, it went into the Monday, if you remember.
Yeah, because we had all had our accommodation and that sorted by the university, and the hotel that they booked, obviously only booked up till the Saturday night, as we were planning to then travel home the Sunday night after it all finished. So luck being luck, it went on to Monday. And my nan and granddad, and the granddad that plays golf, he only lives sort of half an hour away from the Celtic Manor. So I sort of rang him on the off chance if he could come and pick me and three boys up to stay at their house for the night, and if he could drop us back down in the morning for the Monday morning, because there was no chance we were going to miss the final day. he actually ended up picking us up and making quite a fan of himself with all my mates that I'd only been at university with for sort of 2 or 3 weeks. So
crashing out at granddad's place was pretty cool that night.
Yeah. yes, it's certainly one of the stories that have come out of the university years. So yeah, fond memories.
I think, if I'm not mistaken, again, it was around about the age of 18 that you got your diagnosis of rheumatoid arthritis, and that was in your left knee.
Yeah.
Which over time progressively got a bit worse and eventually spread to your hips, your back and your shoulders. So can you walk me through how you received that news and how you reacted to it?
So it was actually from the week in which I caddied for Tongchai. My knee sort of blew up on the Monday after the competition. And obviously Celtic Manor being Celtic Manor, I thought I'd sort of gone down a slope badly on the knee or done sort of damage to it. So I went to the doctors in the hospital, then got in touch, and I had to go for scans. And then originally they thought I'd done some ligament damage. So I went into the hospital for them to do keyhole surgery on ligament damage. But when they actually went in, they discovered that it was rheumatoid arthritis that was causing the inflammation rather than any damage. So at that point it was sort of, okay, my knee's fine to go, I can do whatever I like, but I've also now got a condition that is going to be here for the rest of my life. And at that time they did warn me that it could well sort of spread to other parts of the body. So again, it was quite sort of new to me. I always thought of arthritis being sort of an older person yet. So it was very sort of come as a surprise, but at the time I was so determined to do sport and do my golf and get through university that to be perfectly honest, I didn't really pay that much attention to it. It was sort of something that was there that occasionally prohibited me, but at the time, it wasn't all that big a deal. So very quickly went to the back of the mind at that point.
And then gradually, you mentioned that previously you felt like a 60-year-old body had been put onto this 22-year-old mind or shoulders.
Yeah.
So how did this affect your mentality?
Sure. Sort of the second year of university, which was also the second year after I'd had my diagnosis, there was became more and more days that I was very sort of fatigued, pain, sort of inflammation around the joints were becoming more and more frequent. So I've gone from being quite a fit young man that was able to go out for runs to a, sort of, like you say, a 60-year-old man that can't even jog over to the cafe for a drink. So it instantly became quite difficult. Mentally wise, it was frustrating at the time because I'm trying to get into the university team to play in Bucks matches, which is university versus university in England, to which we were quite successful as a team. So being in the team also enabled you to sort of gain some practice, coaching and other stuff as well. So being prohibited from doing that from something that was totally out of your control was quite frustrating. So at the time, there was a lot of sort of anger and frustration towards something that was out of my control in that regard.
Did that have any effect then on the people that you were surrounding yourself with, because perhaps you couldn't do some of the things that you previously done with them? Did that affect your friendships and your social circle?
Sure, definitely. Like at the time, it was my second year of university, and people were going away to do things like go to the gym, for example, or even just go and play golf at that point. And there were many occasions where I was either too tired or had got behind on things that I needed to do for university because I was tired previously, that I was then unable to do things I would want to do in that time. So there are many occasions where they would go and play golf or go and practice, and I just wasn't in the state mentally or physically to go away and practice properly or even swing a golf club. So,
and would tiredness be one of the major factors then? It's something that you wouldn't necessarily think of as being an effect of the condition, but is that one of the main things?
Yeah, because with the condition, it very much inhibits you physically from being able to move, which then I had quite big muscle wastage occur in my legs and sort of my lower back, which meant that sort of even getting up out of a chair or sitting up in bed then became very difficult. So my body was having to put sort of 30, 40, 50% more effort into doing the simple work that was then able to do the sort of more extreme things, because obviously the golf swing is quite ballistic in its sort of style. It like my swing speed dropped, my distance dropped, which being the player that I was quite frustrating. Suddenly the boys were hitting it well past me and I'm suddenly having a hybrid in my hand to hit into a green when they've got short irons and stuff like that. So,
and seemingly it all came to a head in 2014, and I know you've said that you hadn't had a pain-free day for more than 6 months. You'd just become a father, and at the same time you got yourself into a dark place with prescription tablets and other things. So what was going through your mind at that time?
Quite a few things. I obviously got a family at that time. Like you say, I had a little girl that was only sort of 2 or 3 months old, which became very much my world, but also without her knowing became an added pressure as such. At the time I signed off work, receiving benefits, trying to look after the family, after being where I was sort of 2 years prior to that, where I was working quite comfortably, still getting about. Obviously, I was taking tablets at the time to keep my condition in check, but by this time, it sort of got to the point where I was taking sort of 16 to 18 tablets every day just to keep pain and swelling down. And obviously, being on benefits, I've stupidly found the idea of trying to gamble those benefits and get more money, sort of the dream scenario of needing money to get more money, essentially became too much, and very quickly found myself in quite a lot of trouble. Well, I'd say quite a lot of trouble. I was spending money that I didn't have, not to the extremes that you sometimes see of people, but instead of going to buy food and that for the family, I was going to sort of try my luck and ended up losing it. So put my family in more trouble rather than good. So it came to a head, sort of like you say, Halloween in 2014, where we'd planned to go out with the kids. Obviously, it was my little first Halloween, so we dressed her up as a pumpkin. We were all planning to go out, and I had to go into town to do some banking and also to put some cash that we had into the bank. However, with the addiction as it was, I decided that I could potentially turn that money into more money, and ended up throwing that away in gambling. To which point then we were unable to buy anything for Halloween. We weren't able to sort of buy the sweets that you would for that evening. So instant sort of guilt, sort of, what am I doing? This is not who my family need to be around. This is not what my family need growing up, and especially a little baby as well. Like, she doesn't need a dad that's going to stand there and blow all the money for no apparent reason, really. So, a silly decision in hindsight, but found myself in hospital that evening after putting myself in front of a car, trying to get help for obviously feeling as low as I was, and in that very dark moment, sort of wanting to end things. So I was in hospital all night, and got spoken to by a psychotherapist, is it? I don't know if that's a right word. And basically she got most of the information out of me that I think I needed to tell myself, really, but hadn't done so. So from that moment on, then I started getting help for my gambling addiction. I was then able to talk to my parents and my other half more openly and more truly, because I'd been lying to them about where money had been going and making up stories, and generally, as an addiction would do, it had hold of me and had me doing things that I wouldn't ever dream of otherwise.
What did it feel like when you were speaking to that psychotherapist? Was there a sense of relief, or how did you feel?
It's very cliche, but it very much felt like a weight had been lifted off my shoulders. Throughout sort of the whole period of the gambling bit, there was always that guilt feeling, even overriding feeling of sort of, what am I doing? Why am I doing this sort of thing? But where that addiction sort of has hold of you, it very quickly overrides that, and you instantly find yourself doing things that you said 5 minutes ago that you wouldn't be doing. So when I was able to sort of talk to someone that I had no idea who she was, didn't know where she lived or anything, but that helped me. I knew that there wouldn't be sort of repercussions or her sort of judging me as such. Whereas if I was to speak to my family or anything, I'd very quickly feel like I'd be being shouted at or could potentially lose my family in that regard. So being able to talk to someone like that, I think, enabled me to get the most out of it. And obviously finding myself doing a silly thing and potentially having my daughter and the family that I've been with for 2 years having no dad at all.
And you mentioned your partner. I know, or I've heard, that you're about to get wed in October.
Yes, currently in the planning stages.
Congratulations.
Thank you. We actually got engaged about 18 months after we met, but we've been putting it off, and I think last October we finally said, right, we need to sort of get this concrete now and make things good for everyone.
Let's get back to golf. So you got back to golf because you'd stopped playing golf a little while, and you'd given the game up for a couple of years, I guess, or for a few years, actually, more than that. So what was it that got you to come back to the game?
It was that overriding sort of this, sort of going through the help that I received and sort of having a clear mind again. The sort of sportsman came back out in me, and I wanted to compete. I wanted to have something, because my love for golf never went away. I still watched the golf. I still followed the golf. I wanted to get back out there and play. So it sort of grew from sort of the gradual range session. At the time, I'd also had to sort of buy second-hand clubs because I'd got rid of my clubs previously to fund the gambling addiction. So I had to sort of find myself some second-hand golf clubs and stuff like that, sort of get going again. Very quickly found myself sort of getting into the swing of it again. But I instantly knew that I was not on the level to compete with the able-bodied people that were at the golf club at the time. And watching the Paralympics and being at the Paralympics in 2012, I sort of thought, well, surely there has to be some sort of form of golf that, I think it was about October time, I did a Google search of disabled golf and a video of Graham Robertson popped up on YouTube And I thought, yeah, that sounds quite good. So I emailed Graham, just asking if I'm even disabled enough to become a member of the association and what's required physically, because obviously disabled is a very broad spectrum of sort of physical ailments as such. So I generally thought it would be some like amputations or limbless or wheelchair bound or something like that. So I very quickly sort of asked, like, am I disabled enough to be able to join you? To which I had a very swift response and a very positive response, and sort of, yes, you're perfect. You can join in with us next March when we start our new season. So that gave me then something to work towards over the winter. Generally, my body then decided that it doesn't like cold weather and doesn't like playing golf in cold weather. So my targets very quickly disappeared as practice became non-existent. But yeah, March came around and the event was actually at Hurtmore, which is only sort of 5 minutes down the road from me. And so I knew the golf course and only had to sort of fall out of bed to be there on time. But that first day was a day that I'll never forget, because obviously I'd been through my battles with what I had, but I was instantly sort of thinking, what am I moaning for? There were guys there that, like I say, were limbless or
right.
Amputations or had a stroke and lost feeling in half of their body, or they were there, they were happy, they were enjoying themselves, they were enjoying their golf. They had no sort of feeling sorry for themselves, that they've got what they've got and they got on with it. And I thought, well, I've still got all my limbs, I've still got everything, like, what have I been moaning for? So it's sort of a very humbling experience, but one that sort of grew upon me. And sort of halfway around that round, it very quickly my competitive instincts kicked in, and I can remember feeling, and I can still feel it now, but I want to be the best disabled golfer that I can be. So I've been working on that ever since then, really.
And you say that golf has been life-changing for you, and certainly speaking to you, it sounds that that's the case. Can you walk me through what golf means to you and how it's had a positive impact on your life?
Yeah. Obviously, before I was disabled and before I got rheumatoid, golf was the one passion, the one sport that enabled me to get out of the house, find a release, like, I can't find the words, but like to cure that competitive spirit to have, and as being an individual sport, it was all down to me. I wasn't having to rely on someone else to perform for me to play well, if you know what I mean. Me performing well meant that my score was performing well. Whereas when I played rugby or football or badminton, I was often having to rely on team members for the result to be good. Whereas this was all down to me, which is something that I very quickly became fond of. I love sort of challenging myself and pushing myself to the limit as such as to what I can achieve. So in that regard, before I became disabled, it was very much the sport that I wanted to pursue. I wanted to become as good as I possibly can do and find a job in the industry that could suit me and could give me a good living and make a life out of. Obviously, that changed then when I became disabled. At the time, it was a release. It was time out the house. I still was not working, so golf gave me the sort of time to go down to the range and let me take my mind off things that I was otherwise sat in the house doing nothing for. And then it's given me friends that I could have only dreamt of. Like, I've made friendships in the Disabled Golf Association that I probably never would have dreamt of having. And friends that would definitely be friends for life. And then that sort of competitive thing again, like, it's given me opportunities to go abroad. It's given me opportunities to sort of showcase disabled golf, and I want to give back to people what it's given to me. It's given me a whole new sort of perspective on life. It's given me a freedom to go out there and express myself on the golf, sort of make as good as I can do on the golf course. So, given me that opportunity to get out of the house and perform as a sportsman, as I have done all my life, is definitely a positive thing.
And you competed, I know, in the European individual in 2016 in Czech Republic. I think you finished top 15 or so. Do you have any aspirations for this year?
This year actually collides with something else that has become very close to my heart, and in the way that I want to give something back to disabled golf. So I won't actually be able to compete this year in the individuals.
What is it that's close to your heart?
It's something that I became aware of in 2016, actually, after going to the Czech Republic and meeting Jana. She emailed me later that year with basically a foundation called the Emil Foundation, which mm-hmm. basically provide young people from the age of 12 to 26 a platform to compete in a European sort of arena. So anyone from Europe can go there and compete in any disabled sport for free, essentially. They only had to pay for their travel costs. So the event is fully subsidized by sponsors and investors that invest in the foundation. And it gives young people the chance to go and try new sports. So, for example, boccia or wheelchair, boccia, anything like that. And I was actually asked to go and sort of be a sort of ambassador for disabled golf at that point. So they sort of, Jana pointed me towards Veronica, who's the organizer, and very quickly sort of made a plan as to how we want to move forward. And Miroslav, who's the Czech disabled golf guy, who I became quite friendly with. We worked an academy out last year in Brno. So we had 15, 16 young disabled kids from Brno come and use Snag mm-hmm. golf equipment, and we taught them sort of the basics of golf and how to have fun with it. And then I competed along with a couple of others in what they call the Masters event. So on a proper golf course with proper equipment, etc., almost like an Edgar event. So we competed in that, and I won that, but I wasn't there to win it. I was there to showcase disabled golf and sort of broadcast disabled golf to every country that was there, essentially.
It's quite amazing how many of the athletes that play in Edgar events are doing other things to really promote the game and to really get people playing the game and give them an opportunity to at least try to play golf. And so it's quite interesting to me to see, and it's obviously good to see. It's a heartwarming thing to see all of these guys giving back to the game. What of all the things that you've learned from playing golf, are there two or three takeaways that you might think others might be able to learn from?
I think patience is one that I've definitely learned. Coming back into sort of golf, I very quickly learned that I had to allow my body to adjust, allow my body to do what it can do and not push it too far, because it would end up in me not being able to do golf for a period of time afterwards. So having patience in whatever condition you've got, you have to allow yourself to not push yourself too far, because it could well end up in you not being able to do something that you love doing. And then again, on the golf course, like, patience on the golf course. Like, yes, you want to go out and have the best score possible. I very quickly learned in the Czech Open last year, I had a very bad hole on my first round, I think it was. But I sort of lost my mind then. I lost my concentration and the rest of the round had gone. Whereas I've learned from that, that if I'd stayed patient and sort of kept sort of mentality that there's still many holes to go, I think I probably would have had a different outcome. So that's definitely one thing I would sort of advise to other disabled golfers and other people. I think the other one was just get out there and get to as many sort of events and people as you can do. Obviously, Edgar do their series events over here in England. We've obviously got the Disabled Golf Association, amongst others, which do many, many events throughout England. Just getting out there and putting yourself out there. I know for some people that can be quite difficult, and certainly for me, it wasn't easy that first day at Hartmoor. But doing it is the first step to sort of moving on and moving into something that's really, for me, has changed my life. So actually sort of putting yourself out there and doing golf as a disabled athlete is certainly something that you can move forward with and progress with.
Are there any adjustments that you would make to make the game more user-friendly for golfers with disability?
I think user-friendly is sort of, in terms of sort of the Edgar sort of circuit, where you've got sort of everyone competing on what is pronounced as an elite level, I think that is sort of already quite accessible, other than sort of the funding side of things. Obviously, many, many players all have to self-fund themselves to be able to go to the events. Obviously, being the amateur status that we carry, we can't sort of have sponsors' income or anything like that to be able to meet those events and meet the sort of entry requirements and stuff like that. So probably on that side of things, there isn't a lot more that you can do to make it more accessible other than to do the events for free, which is not going to ever be the case because there are always costs involved and sort of that's always going to be an issue. But sort of the grassroots level, I definitely feel that there should be more coaches trained in disabled coaching as such, so they have an understanding of ailments that a disabled golfer may come to them with and things that they may have to adjust to. And then also having more of a public outlook for disabled golf, so more sort of publicity in the disabled golf sort of aspect of mainstream media, so golf magazines and stuff. There have been some nice articles like Chris Foster in the Golf Monthly magazine, I think it was, turning pro as an amputee sort of thing. But that, like, for us, our major events are never really broadcast to anyone but the Edgar website and the competitors' Facebook as such. We never sort of get that mainstream media of Golf Monthly or Golf Weekly or whatever it may be. Sky Sports have obviously started following and filming the European team championships and that. And that's certainly a massive step forward in sort of broadcasting the elite side of things. But I think the sort of grassroots and the small groups of people, so like the Disabled Golf Association events and stuff, if they were more broadcast to people, so events were more publicised and that, I think we'd be able to get more disabled people into disabled golf.
Yeah, I think to some degree that's what these profile interviews are about. The driver for doing these interviews is that we believe very much, very, very strongly that everybody's got a story.
Yeah.
And that we all learn from everybody else's story, regardless. And I think that as I say, the driver for this would be that there's a lot of people out there that perhaps have a family friend or themselves or a family member who has got a disability, who perhaps has now been taken out of their normal social circle because they, let's say, for argument's sake, used to play football, but now they've lost a leg and it's not so easy for them to continue to play with the same people. So they lose their social circle, but now they've got, what do we do now?
Yeah.
And as we know, you know specifically because you've been involved in the game for as long as you have, that everybody can play this game. And so maybe this is an option for them to play golf and to get back into a sport that not only can they enjoy as a participant, but they can also enjoy as a competitor and even represent their country.
Yeah.
So I think that's part of the reason for what we're trying to do with the profiles. And certainly these stories are making some difference.
Yeah, and I think one thing to add to that is the actual accessibility at golf clubs, like membership schemes. You have your intermediate membership schemes and then your full sort of schemes for young people and then older people.
Mm-hmm.
But I've not, in the sort of 4 years that I've been looking, found a golf club that has a disabled person's membership. Obviously, we're trying to be inclusive and some people don't want to be sort of singled out as being disabled. But then there are people that require a buggy to go around a golf course. There are people that can only play for a certain amount of time a year. So having a membership that can allow for that, I think, would achieve more people being at a golf club. And then from that can then potentially meet other disabled people that are already at the golf club that no one really knew about, or they never sort of put themselves out there as being disabled as such.
Yeah, I think you make a very good point there. And we also know that not only are many people that are disabled, not only are they disabled, but they're also disadvantaged in that perhaps they need somebody to go with them to the golf course.
Yeah.
If it's maybe in the case of a blind person or maybe somebody in a wheelchair. And so it's not quite so easy as waking up in the morning and looking out the window and say, it's a nice day today, let's go play golf. It's the organisation of, well, you know, I now need to organise my transportation there. I need to organise my guide to go with me or my partner to go with me. And so it's just not quite so easy. So I think you make a very valid point. Tell me, is there anything about Ashley that might surprise us?
I would probably say that being only 26 and having 5 children, a full-time job, and obviously playing golf as much as I do, I'd say that probably surprised most people are surprised that I have 5 children by the age of 26.
That takes some managing.
Yes. So, yeah, I think that would probably be the one thing that surprised them. And golf-wise, I'd probably say it was the fact that I've only been playing the game just over 10 years, I suppose.
And tell me, which piece of your golf equipment gives you the most joy?
Oh, so it used to be my putter, because I had a custom Scotty Cameron that I used to love the look of. However, I couldn't get on with it, so I no longer have it. I'll probably say my wedge that gives me most joy, my pitching wedge, just because that's my comfortable yardage and I'm generally quite dialed in with it. So getting on a golf course and having a wedge in my hand generally gives me the most joy.
If I could offer you a flight at a golf course, so there's 4 of you going to play, so you've now got 3 partners to select, and they can be either dead or alive. And you don't even know if they play golf or not, so you don't have to know that. Who would your 3 playing partners be and why?
One of them would be my granddad. Just because without him, I probably wouldn't have picked up the game, because he probably wouldn't have got my brother involved at an early age, and it probably would have never been a sport I picked up until I probably retired or something, because it would have been football and rugby and badminton. So he would definitely be on there. I'd have to say Seve Ballesteros. He was always idolised at that point. He'd already become an idol. He'd already become someone that was coming to the end of their career. So I just enjoyed his charisma and his sort of personality. So I think going around a golf course with his sort of personality and charisma and his style of play, essentially, would be something that I just couldn't miss out on. And then probably the last one would be my current sort of idol, which would be Rory McIlroy. Just for the fact that he very much sort of his homegrown story from where he was in Northern Ireland and how he's pushed himself and grown into where he is now. Very much sort of is how I would go about my business as if I had that opportunity. And his talent, and he's also someone that's very much down to earth.
I assume you'd be rooting for him in a few weeks' time at the Masters.
Yes, very much so. I'm just hoping he's got his putter sorted out by then.
Just a final question really for you is that if you could magically be with somebody who's got a similar disability as yourself, what advice would you want to offer them?
Just keep going would be it. Like, never, ever give up. You're always going to have bad days, but the bad days always disappear. Bad times never stick around. Just keep plugging, just keep going. You're better off than many other people, put it that way. For me, like, I often sort of pull up at a disabled event and people that may not recognise me or people that haven't seen me before are very quick to judge that I'm not disabled because I have what is a hidden disability. So I don't have sort of a false leg or a prosthetic or anything that's obvious to people. So I would sort of say, just keep plugging on, strive to be as good as you can.
Thank you for that. I mean, that's really good advice. And Ashley, thank you very much for your time. I know it's not easy. You mentioned earlier your full-time work, you've got a big family there to look after, and I'm sure the demands on your time are quite strong. So thank you very much for giving us the time to chat today.
That's all right. No problem at all.
If people would like to reach you, how can they find you?
I would say probably Facebook or LinkedIn. Facebook's the obvious one. Generally, I'm on there every day trying to do things, and that's where I'm sort of most of the time. If people want to chat to one of me, just sort of send me a friend request or a message request, and I'll be more than happy to get back to them.
Great. Well, thank you for that. And again, thanks for your time. And by the way, 20th of October, it's a great date.
Good. I look forward to it.
Okay. Take care. Thanks, Ashley.
Cheers. Thank you,
Danny. Ciao. Bye.
Bye-bye.